instructs them not to use drugs or how we should punish them if they do. This morning we will be looking at a different side of this issue, that is the supply side, and we'll be talking with Rensselaer Lee about a book that he's written entitled The White Labyrinth, Cocaine and Political Power. Rensselaer Lee is president of Global Advisory Services Incorporated, an Alexandria, Virginia-based company that consults on international development issues. He is also an associate scholar at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And in fact, this book is part of a series of works sponsored by the Foreign Policy Research Institute. In addition, Mr. Lee has testified on drug trafficking and drug abuse issues before the House Subcommittee on Western Hemisphere Affairs and other congressional forums. His book, The White Labyrinth, is published by Transaction Publishers. As he explains in the introduction, it is a study which profiles the South American cocaine industry and comes to a number of conclusions, which I'll summarize here for you briefly, and we will speak about them in more detail. He explains that the cocaine industry serves as an important source of jobs, income, and foreign exchange for the producer nations, that powerful constituencies have developed within and among the growers, the producers, and distributors, that governments in the region don't see the cocaine industry as a threat to their survival, and even if they did, they lack the resources to battle those in the drug trade. And further, the leaders of the Andean nations are afraid that a successful crackdown on drugs could destabilize their economies and breed new and lethal political challenges. He says, in summing the book, that the solution to the drug problem, if there is one, lies not in the producer nations but in the United States, with trying to convince the 6 million people now who use cocaine to be persuaded to change their habits. As we talk with Rensselaer Lee, you are invited to call in. Perhaps you'll have questions or comments to pass on to us. We welcome your participation in our conversation. The telephone number here locally is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere you hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Now, just bear in mind, it is a little bit different. The local number, 333-WILL, and the toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Lee, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's a pleasure.
I think I'd like to begin by having you talk a bit about cocaine and its role in the economies of the Andean nations, and perhaps we could look both at a micro level and a macro level and talk a little bit first about what's in it for the growers. It is apparently something that has become very popular because it is one of the most profitable cash crops they can grow. I suppose they could choose to grow other things. Why is it that so many people seem to have become involved in growing the coca, which later gets turned into cocaine?
Well, there are a couple of issues here. The first issue is that the coca plant is a very profitable crop, and it's 2, 3, 4 times as profitable as any alternative crop that could be grown in the areas where coca is grown, for example, in the Upper Huallaga Valley in Peru or in the Chapare region in Bolivia. But you also have to look at some of the forces, the economic forces in these countries, which are driving people into the coca fields to grow coca or to be involved in other ways in the cocaine trade there. And there you have to look at some of the other problems that are occurring in the economies, especially in Peru and Bolivia, where the formal economies for most of this decade have been sliding downhill. The tin mines have closed in Bolivia, and people are leaving the tin industry to go to the coca fields to look for work. And you find also a very serious problem in many parts of the Peruvian economy. So it is a push-pull situation.
Mm-hmm. How much money does the cocaine industry generate as compared with other industries?
Well, I think there are a number of estimates, none of which are terribly firm based on very good data, but we think that cocaine brings into the Peruvian economy each year somewhere between $500 million and $700 million. And that's a fairly hefty chunk of Peruvian legitimate exports, which I think are in the neighborhood of 2.6 or $2.7 billion. I don't know the exact figure.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Bolivia, it's somewhere between, I think, $300 million, $400 million coming in out of total legal exports of somewhere around $600 million. So we're talking about a fairly hefty chunk of foreign exchange, which is being repatriated to these countries.
And does that money actually stay in the country?
Well, a lot of it does. A lot of it goes to pay, of course, the coca farmers. Some of it's invested. A lot of it goes to purposes which are not terribly helpful to the economy, such as bribes to public officials. Some of it may leave these countries again, but a fair amount of it, I think, stays.
Mm-hmm. Some people may be troubled by looking at this issue this way, but if one could take it from a purely economic standpoint, would one have to conclude that the cocaine industry is good for these countries, for Colombia, Bolivia, Peru, the top producers?
Well, I don't like to use this word good for these economies because, first of all, the cocaine industry is a renegade industry. So, and by this I mean that the money that comes in from cocaine is not used in ways, or much of it is not used in ways that are economically very rational. If the same amount of money were coming in from legal exports, it would be much, much better for the economies of these countries. A lot of the cocaine income is spent, is recycled in the cocaine business itself, or it's spent on bribes, on building up private armies in ways. It generates corruption, it generates violence, it's spent in ways that are economically harmful.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that it does generate employment, it does bring in foreign exchange, it does help with the balance of payments, and this is especially the case in Peru and Bolivia. You find that the cocaine industry has gained a fairly powerful economic foothold because the legal economies of these countries are very weak. So in a way, you can look upon the cocaine industry as performing a kind of a safety valve, an economic safety valve function, or it's kind of a holding action. It's not really propelling these economies forward, but it may be keeping them afloat in a way.
Yeah. Perhaps another way of asking the question would be, what would be the effect if one could, in a very short period of time, in a day, a week, suddenly just completely cut the demand and make cocaine a totally worthless commodity?
If we could do that, if we legalized the cocaine and or if we eliminated demand for cocaine, or if we somehow got permission from the South American governments to go down there and spray all of their coca crop, and the cocaine industry disappeared within 2 weeks, the economic consequences for these countries would be catastrophic.
Mm-hmm.
Because the coca and cocaine industry, again, it has gained a very powerful economic foothold, and it employs a great many people. We're talking about possibly somewhere between 750,000 and 1 million people that are being employed all through the Andean countries in one phase or another of the cocaine business. Either they're growing the crop or they're involved in various processing or transportation functions. So it's kind of it can be looked at as kind of a almost like a cancer, a surgery on the cocaine industry could be fatal to the economies of say Bolivia and Peru.
Uh-huh. Our guest this morning again is Rensselaer Lee. He's president of Global Advisory Services Incorporated, and we're talking with him about his book, The White Labyrinth, Cocaine and Political Power. It is a profile of the South American cocaine industry, about the ways in which that industry is tied into the economies and the political systems of those countries. We would be happy to take your questions. In fact, I have one person on hold right now. We'll get to. If you'd like to call in, A local number is 333-WILL or 9455. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455. Let's take our first caller here on the toll-free line. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm a bit apprehensive when I hear someone use a term like cancer about business transactions or any other aspect of society, because the word cancer is such a value-laden term. In other words, it indicates to me that the person that uses that term doesn't like that particular activity, although people who benefit from that activity, of course, like it and would never use the term cancer. There's another phrase that your guest used, and I wondered if you could put it in a little further context. He used the term renegade economy. Now, when you use that phrase, do you mean like the alcohol economy during Prohibition in the United States? Was that a renegade economy as well? And then I had a question about indigenous use of the coca leaves.
Well, I use the term renegade economy. It's an illegal economy, and there are certain, I think, common structural features of illegal economies in various parts of the world. I'm not really an expert on the prohibition situation the way it was in the United States, but I think there are probably some similarities there. The money that is used or that is generated through illegal activities, I would argue, is not as economically productive as if the same amount of money had been generated through legal activities. Because an awful lot of the money goes to support coteries of corrupt officials, to build private armies, it's spent on weapons, it's spent on, and not all that much is invested. I mean, if the same amount of money, for example, were being generated from selling oranges or macadamia nuts or something, a legal crop or a legal product abroad, I think that the economic effects would be a lot healthier. But this is not to say, I use the term cancer in the sense that the cocaine economy has become very important in South America. It is kind of piggybacked on the legal economy, and it's not something that can be done away with very quickly. Or, to put it otherwise, if the cocaine industry disappeared very rapidly in South America, there would be very severe economic consequences. But at the same time, I don't see the cocaine economy as doing the rest of the economy much good. The cocaine economy is not helping to push the Peruvian legal economy or the Bolivian legal economy forward.
And you do see the coffee economy of, say, Colombia as a good investment, therefore it's not a cancer? I mean, for example, if there were discovery that cancer, real cancer, became related to the drinking of coffee in the Western world, and we stopped drinking coffee and the coffee economy collapsed, would then we look back and say, well, that was really not a profitable enterprise, therefore it was a cancer?
Well, it's a legal enterprise, and this means that the controls, the way the money flows, the controls, the way the enterprise functions is very different. And I think if cocaine became legal, I don't think this is going to happen anytime soon. But I think if the cocaine industry became legal, it would in many respects begin to resemble other types of industries that generate legal illicit exports.
Can I ask the one question about the coca leaf in the culture,
sure,
indigenous cultures of the Andean countries? Now, my understanding is that we have pretty good history on it being about 5,000 years old, and that's been legal. I wonder if you could talk a bit about what role the coca leaf has played in the legal relationship to those cultures.
Sure, and it's played a very important role in Andean civilization and Andean culture generally in the two countries where it's been legal, in Peru and Bolivia. The coca leaf serves a variety of medicinal and ritual elementary functions in these countries. Chewing the coca leaf helps to ward off the effects of hunger and also high altitude. It's I'm not an expert on this aspect of it, but it plays a very important role in the culture of these countries. But what has happened since about the earlier mid 1970s is that with the demand for cocaine developing in the United States and also more recently in Western Europe, the vast majority of the coca leaves that are grown in these countries are being grown for the illegal cocaine market, not for the illegal market for chewing.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
All right. I thank you for the call. Again, the questions are welcome. Our comments, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I'd be interested in having you talk a little bit about the ways in which growers and producers are organized and have managed to affect policy, managed to gather to themselves political power. I wonder if you could do that. In particular, the lobby, the growers' lobby, and also then the ways in which those people that are further up in the production strata, the refiners and the distributors have become involved in the politics of the producing countries.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at the growers first. In Bolivia, you have about 10 different regional federations of coca growers, and coca growers represent a very significant force in the Bolivian in Bolivian society and in the Bolivian political system. These 10 different regional federations also receive direct political support from the National Peasants Union and the National Labor Union, which is kind of the overarching union organization for all of Bolivia. Now, if you look at the coca lobby in Bolivia, that is the organizations which are involved in pushing the program, the case, the demands of coca growers, you're talking about organizations which encompass roughly 20% of the Bolivian population. That is, the coca lobby writ large in Bolivia includes about 20% of the entire Bolivian population. Now, the coca growers themselves, in other words, have got a great deal of national political support from national peasant and labor unions. And this gives them the chance, gives them the power to exercise tremendous influence over government policies that affect coca. And because they have such tremendous numbers and such tremendous political clout, the government of Bolivia is not capable of implementing an involuntary, a forcible eradication program. That is, coca is not eradicated in Bolivia unless it is eradicated by permission of the peasants' federations themselves. And the way that these peasants' federations who have been involved in pressuring the government now for a good many years, the way that they make their demands felt is through doing things like blocking down the national, shutting down the national highway system, or surrounding the city of Cochabamba, which is Bolivia's third largest city, and simply the tactics that they use are extremely disruptive and have succeeded in getting the government's attention.
Well, we have another caller here on one of our local lines. Let's talk with them. I'll go here to line number one. Hello.
Hello. My question follows this gentleman's answer just now. let me play the devil advocate and ask you if, in your testimony and your work in Washington and with our governmental people, are they saying that the United States and other nations must suffer the consequences of all the effects of drug addiction on our population in order to sustain the economies of these third world countries that grow cocoa, and that that's the price we pay to sustain them in a sense, that we can't disrupt their economies too much because what would follow would be so much worse?
Well, I think there are a number of issues. I think that if we go in there, I really wonder whether we would have the capability of doing anything in these countries. I mean, even if we were controlling Bolivia and Peru, even in some kind of a, if you can imagine a situation where we were either running these countries ourselves or whether the governments of Peru and Bolivia gave us the right to operate against the drug trade there. There are so many people now that are dependent on the coca plant or on processing the coca plant into cocaine. So many people that depend on this business now for a living that I could imagine a situation where we could get deeply involved in a kind of a long-term, very debilitating, guerrilla-type war in these countries. And this is what scares me. This is, I think, what scares the people in Washington. Certainly, we would like to get rid of the cocaine traffic. Certainly, we don't want to take steps or we don't want our policies down there to support this menace. But we have to worry about whether, in fact, the cure might in fact be worse than the disease.
Well, now that's what you said in the
last.
Right.
That's right. That's right. And this means that we have to think in terms of a fairly long term and protracted struggle against this problem, not in terms of a quick solution, because quick solutions could turn into political disasters for these countries, and also we have to think in terms of other U.S. interests that we have in these countries, and we have to think in terms of such an unstable situation where these countries simply might cease to function as viable political entities.
Well, then
we look at the additional scenario of U.S. involvement down there.
Well, let me repeat my question again.
Yeah.
You didn't answer it. I said, are the people in Washington saying that the price our people pay, the price our youth pay, the whole drug culture on the streets and all the ill health and is the price we pay so as it was not to upset these economies down south in the way you just suggested, not some immediate quick solution or intervention or anything like that? Are our politicians and people saying that's tough, but that's the price we pay?
Well, I think our politicians are saying that there are no quick solutions to this problem, and that we have to think in terms of a very long-term anti-drug effort, and that the main emphasis of this drug effort is going to have to be on reducing demand in this country.
All right, one last question. Suppose we do, in the next decade or two, reduce the drug demand through education and all other sorts locally.
Right.
What is then going to replace what these South American drug growing countries will have to sustain their economies and politics?
They're going to have to make an adjustment. But the difference in between doing it that way and doing it through, shall we say, sending down a fleet of American airplanes and spraying the entire coca crop in these countries is that it would give these economies time to adjust. I'm looking at it now purely from the perspective of South American countries.
I understand that. One last question.
Yeah.
Does anybody talk about a big agricultural subsidy to South American farmers in the same way we give our farmers for a more viable and...
Oh, sure. I mean, you have UN people down working in Bolivia that say that we ought to subsidize the production, the cultivation, production of oranges and other crops. The trouble is that crops that are grown in the coca-producing areas tend to be very expensive. These areas are very remote from major markets. They don't have good transportation infrastructures. It's hard to bring these crops out. When they do come out, they cost more. It's easier probably for Bolivia to import oranges from, or rice or whatever from, from other countries than it is to try to produce this stuff, produce these crops in the coca-producing areas.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome if you want to give us a call. We're talking this morning with Rensselaer Lee, president of Global Advisory Services Incorporated. It's an Alexandria, Virginia-based company that consults on international development issues. He is also an associate scholar at the Foreign Policy Research Institute in Philadelphia and is author of the book The White Labyrinth. This morning we're talking with Rensselaer Lee. Again, his book is entitled The White Labyrinth. It is a profile of the South American cocaine industry. If you have questions for us, please do call locally, 333-9455. Toll free, anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. It sounds, Mr. Lee, from what you were saying and from having looked at your book, that if we decide that we want to attack this problem from the supply side, we really don't have any very good options to do that.
We don't. It's a very depressing situation. I was thinking about that as I was writing the book. I wish I could come up with something that would be a little bit hopeful. But almost everything that we recommend has got something against it, or even some major drawback. Eradicating peasants' crops is certainly a bad solution. I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of people in Bolivia and Peru who depend on cultivation of coca for a living. We go in there and we tear up their coca fields, or we spray them, or whatever. And in Peru, you'll drive these coca farmers into the ranks of guerrilla movements, particularly the Sendero Luminoso. In Bolivia, you'll have a full-scale revolt on your hands. I don't think the Bolivian government would have the power to deal with the political fallout of a major involuntary eradication program. Not to mention the fact that cocaine traffickers themselves have got tremendous political power and influence in these countries, especially, I think, in Bolivia and Colombia. Hmm. And it's hard to think up a supply reduction strategy that will work, but at the same time won't have very serious economic and political consequences for these countries. And none of the supply side strategies I see are really going to work.
All right, let's
talk. The eradication option, I think, is bad. In fact, that the eradication option is now being downplayed by Secretary Bennett's office. Hmm. I think that office realizes that there are tremendous political risks in going in and tearing up peasants' coca crops. The quickest way to create a peasant revolution. We can give a lot of aid to these countries. The Bush administration has given $65 million in military and logistical aid to Colombia. But this aid isn't really going to have much of an impact on the war against drugs in Colombia, because the Colombian institutions are very heavily infiltrated by the Colombian cocaine cartels, and this capacity of these wealthy drug traffickers to penetrate, to establish informants and accomplices in important government institutions is certainly an aspect of the war that very little outside help, very little that we can do here in this country can affect that situation.
Well, I have some other callers here. Let's talk with them. We'll go to line one next. Hello?
Mr. Lee, I would like to play a little devil's advocate. Doesn't the same problem exist on the other way around, too? I mean, I worked in Latin America for a while, and it's very surprising for many people down there that American chemical industries are still selling DDT by the ton and drugs that are outlawed here. The arms industry is making also a very good living by a process that works very similar, only on a different level. Could you make a statement to that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I fully understood your question.
I mean, my question is, for example, DDT was outlawed in the United States a long time ago.
Right.
If you go to Guatemala, if you go to Colombia, if you go to Peru, you can still get it by the kilo, and it's used, and it's used usually by people that don't even know how to read and write. The instructions are in English, so they are very likely misused. The pesticides, I mean, for example, in Guatemala, the pesticides are used and sprayed on the crops by kids that have no protection at all. It comes actually back then to us in form of grapes from Chile and bananas. There's really a much deeper problem there that is also a drug problem.
Mm-hmm. But do you want me to comment on the use of sprays or pesticides?
We react very, very sort of sensitively and very rightly so about Colombia flooding United States with drugs. Mm-hmm. That destroy our social structures and cities and are devastating. Mm-hmm. But on the long run, there is also a drug problem out there that really has its roots somewhere else. That also deals in a very sophisticated way with power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well. There's so many different facets to this problem, and I tend to look at see this problem as developing partly out of a long-standing, I think, almost neglect of Latin America on the part of the United States,
uh-huh.
And even by the Latin American elites themselves. I mean,
that's
people
right.
who understand the urban scene. In Latin America, people who live in the major cities, people who never go leave the major cities, really, except maybe to travel to other countries or to Europe or possibly to the United States. I mean, this whole problem has been developing; it's been growing now for about the past 20 years or so. It's something that we have not had a really good grasp of because there are very few people, certainly in this country, who are experts on. Rural South America,
yeah.
Or understand the problems. I mean, some of the problems that have been driving people out of traditional occupations into farming coca or into other coca or cocaine related occupations. I mean, this problem has kind of crept up on us.
Yeah, I mean,
and we've been spending huge amounts of money here in this country on studying, you know, the Soviet China problem and you know the Sino-Soviet split, and we've got. You know, lots of centers for the study of communism here in this country, which hopefully I think now will be largely obsolete, many of them. But we haven't really had a very good understanding of the situation.
No, but there's also, I think, another problem that maybe many of these oligarchies that are in power down there, they don't see the global consequence. I mean, they only see maybe the bank account in Miami or in some Swiss or in Liechtenstein or somewhere else, and they don't see what they are really doing to the next generation or to the whole global economy, you know. I mean, that actually leads me to another thing, that there's the whole complicity of the banking system to profit from that excess of money, you know,
The bankers I talked to down there basically take the attitude that all money is green. They said if they said, well, we're not going to accept this money, then they said the money would flow into North American banks. I mean, they figure, well, why should we Colombians or we Peruvians or we Bolivians suffer?
Yeah.
Really, I think there's so many problems, differences in the ways that we perceive the problem and that South Americans perceive the problem. In Colombia, for example, now there's a big war going on against the cocaine industry. But is it really now a war against the cocaine industry, or is the government just trying to capture Pablo Escobar?
Yeah. No, thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. We have a couple of other people here who are holding on. We'll go on to our next caller. on our toll-free line. Hello?
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 Yes.
Hello. Okay, well, I have a question and a comment. I appreciate the callers, especially the last caller apparently has had experience there, and he sees the problems of these countries in very realistic and firsthand. I am Colombian, and I have lots of contact with students since I am a teacher here in Illinois. And I am very touched. This becomes more of an emotional issue as well as very practical, in that they blame Colombians or Peruvians or Bolivians for the problems of drug addiction in this country. And I would like Mr. Lee to clarify something that I have first-hand knowledge, and I think I do, and I would like to make that very clear, because as I recall, the Colombian drug industry began with funds, support, know-how from North American enterprise, obviously very dishonest, and I am not saying all Americans, but those who went down there and taught Colombians how to process, how to hide, took the laboratories and the airplanes and implanted this horrible industry in the jungles of Colombia. First of all, I want you to answer me if I'm right. Am I right about this beginning of this drug in Colombia?
Well, I've read many of the same books that you've read on this, and I've heard everything, that there was former Peace Corps volunteers or Colombian students returning from the United States, or Chileans who were thrown out of work when the Allende regime fell and the Pinochet regime came in, and thereupon Pinochet suppressed the cocaine industry in Chile, and a lot of these Chilean chemists, supposedly the finest cocaine chemists in the world, moved to Colombia. I've heard reports about a Cuban connection, Cubans coming down there. I think there may have been some North Americans coming to Colombia to help, but I think that there were also people in these other categories that I mentioned, Cubans, returning Colombian students, and Chileans. So I'm sure that the Colombians got help from other sources, but I think it was probably a wide variety of other sources, and certainly not just the United States.
Right, right. And I don't want to make a general statement. I love this country. I am an American citizen. I have sons that are American citizens and a husband who was born here. But the thing that bothers me is, among the people that are ignorant about this subject, they do generalize, make blanket statements about people from other countries, and group all of them together as though we were living off of the income that the United States sends there. And it would be so wonderful if people became educated as far as what the politics and the economic interests of the United States and these countries. You know, of course they have very small economies. Simply, they are not diversified enough. But also, the loans they get from the United States are at such high interest that they sell their souls forever, paying interest. And their one product is underpaid, or exports are not as they expected to. And in other words, my comment is that people here believe that they are supporting and that those countries are leeches on the United States and other developed countries. And that is far from the truth. I think that things could be different economically for those countries.
Well, I think so, too, and I didn't mean to cut you in before you finish your thought, but there are many, many, many people here in Washington, and I'm one of them, that feel that the drug problem is at root an economic problem, and that what we need to do is to get the economies of these countries, especially Peru and Bolivia, but Colombia also, as you know, has economic problems. We need to get these Andean economies moving again. And there are a number of things that have been proposed, for example, to amendments that would allow us to help these countries produce crops that are also produced in the United States, and there's been a problem there for some time, but we're trying to with new congressional legislation, allow this kind of aid to go into these countries. We're trying to now, senator Senator Biden, in fact, is talking about a so-called debt for drug swap, by which a certain amount of the debt of these countries will be forgiven if they're able to make certain progress against in eradicating coca crops or destroying cocaine laboratories or arresting major traffickers or something like that. And I think that there are a number of things that we can do to help the economies. The only thing is that we got to realize that this industry is now so powerful, so well entrenched, and employs so many people that just because the economy start to improve, it doesn't mean that the problem is just that, you know, people are just going to voluntarily leave the cocaine industry and go into something else. And it's going to take a long time for these kinds of major changes to really occur.
We just have a couple of minutes left. I have two other callers. I'd like to try to get at least one of them in. I hope the last caller will forgive me if I go on, and I want to thank her for the call. Let's go next to line number two. Hello.
Yes, the lady answered one of my questions that I had about this cocoa plant, how it got started. What basically are other uses that the cocoa plant could be used for? And did it ever have any uses besides this miserable drug?
Well, yes. I mean, it's been used for a long time as a hunger suppressant and also to enable people to cope with the effects of altitude. There are many people in South America that believe that the cocoa plant could be, that extracts from the cocoa plant could be used to cure or at least to regulate diabetic conditions, to help people in losing weight. There are a number of experimental products that are being produced from the coca plant, including, for example, a coca wine that supposedly does not leave a hangover, and, again, various types of medicines.
What was its basic use for when it was first invented?
Well, it was really, I think, it wasn't invented. It's been growing there for thousands and thousands of years in these Andean countries. But it's been used to help people cope with the effects of altitude, and to suppress symptoms of hunger.
Okay, now I
sort of it's a food substitute. It does have some minerals. It does have some nutrients in it.
I see. So I think, like most other things, the plant grew, and then we varied and found something devious to use it for.
That's right.
But I wanted to say, I think our main problem is world trade. When we get into world trade, we want so many exports, we want so many imports in order to balance things. Now, I did see something positive several weeks back in November. I saw some cotton towels from Colombia, and I nearly fell over. Are you aware that they are shipping in cotton?
Yeah, well, they're shipping in a lot of legal exports, flowers, coffee, oil. And,
mm-hmm.
But I'm glad they're getting into textiles, too, will they?
Yes, this is the first, and I nearly flipped when I saw that. So I think we do have to cut down the supply. I think we have to turn this cocoa plant into something more desirable than blowing our minds. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the call. Let me get one last caller real quick here on line number one. Fred, I have to ask you to be brief if you can.
Okay, David, just to see if your guests can comment, and you may have already covered this, a story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal about the economy in South Florida benefiting and actually looking the other way on the cocaine trafficking because of anybody from real estate, people that buy and sell real estate to luxury car dealers to yacht salesmen, you know, the whole economy down there benefits from all the cocaine money that's down there in South Florida.
Well, we have to admit that this chain of drug-related corruption and the flow of drug money, this extends well beyond South America, extends through the Caribbean, and of course into South Florida. I think there's no question about these economic effects. The only thing that you don't seem to have in South Florida is sort of a cocaine lobby, people that get up there and say, you know, tell their congressmen, tell their representatives, tell the mayor of Miami, you know, don't crack down too hard on the cocaine industry because it's bad for business. You don't have these kinds of effects happening yet in Miami.
We're going to have to stop there. Mr. Lee, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're most welcome.
Once again, our guest, Rensselaer Lee, is president of Global Advisory Services Incorporated. It's an Alexandria-based Virginia company that consults on international development issues. And if you would like to read more on this topic, you might look at his book. It's entitled The White Labyrinth, Cocaine and Political Power, and Transaction is the publisher.